Don't mind.
But is that an enormous bong?
Yeah, this is how I
It's how you unwind after a long day. Oh my god! I didn't expect a blowtorch, I have to be honest.
I like to dive very deeply into hobbies, obsessively deep into hobbies, some might say, and a hobby that I picked up at some point in time might have been some sort of lockdown or something. I don't know why I had the time, but I started taking some logs. Somebody in my neighborhood cut up a bunch of trees, and so I like drug a bunch of them over to my house, and I had this idea that I was going to basically dig a hole into it that would be the size of a pot that you might plant something in. And so it'd be like this totem pole that then had a plant growing out of it. And then I used the blowtorch to char the wood. And then I put stencils on it. And I bought myself a Dremel, which is a German tool. German-made.
What's a Dremel?
A Dremel. It's like a... It's got its name, but Dremel's the brand. It's like you can do anything. You can carve, you can cut glass, you can sand and make all these like little minuscule detailed things. So I, on these charred stumps with plants growing out of them, I started putting some designs on them. And then it turned out when I had gotten to about five of them and they looked pretty beautiful, that the reason they were cut down was because they were infested with fungus gnats.
And ooh, I never heard of those before.
I really had never heard either. And then one day we were all sitting around, we're like, oh, what the fuck is this? What is this? And it was these swarms of these weird clear bugs with little green booties. We were like, it's the logs. And we got them out of here. So now they live in like this little, we live right next to a train track, which you might hear a train at some point. And now they live right next to, right there. I don't know. It's kind of cute. You'll see it when I see you soon.
Yeah, I'm going to be there really soon. And I do want to see that. I just looked it up. The Dremel is a rotary tool. The Dremel 4000 rotary. It's a rotary tool, but I see what you mean. Yeah, I've seen these before. This is actually really handy. I hadn't thought about what that was called before.
They're super handy.
So let's talk a little bit, actually. So like I've mentioned to people on the previous couple of shows, first off, Matt, I'm very honored to have you for the 100th episode of the show. It's a little sad that we couldn't get Mo on this one, but you know, c'est la vie. We're in different countries, and he's as busy gets. But I'm very glad to have you as a guest, and I explained it to people before, but the reason why, while I'm on this trip, I'm interviewing friends and you know, peers and stuff who aren't immigrants, is because for the time being, I can't really interview people who have moved abroad, except for whoever might just coincidentally be in New Orleans at the time. Because right. In this moment, I'm not really an immigrant. Right now, I'm back home.
Well,
so, you know, what I want to focus on while I'm here is the first part of the title. Like, it's artsy fartsy immigrants, but since I'm not really able to focus so much on the immigrant part just on this trip, I wanted to take the opportunity to talk to people who are hella artsy-fartsy, like yourself, but aren't necessarily, you know, immigrants. So, you're an actor, you're a rapper, you're a poet, you're a creator, you've produced things, you've written things. You know, I know
directed
we've known each other
things,
for a...
Yeah.
You did what things?
Directed some.
Yeah,
movies.
You directed. That's right. Yeah, Mom, we have to talk about Mama's Little.
I'm a doodler. I'm a doodler.
You're a drawer. That's true.
I like to draw. But go on. I'm sorry. I just didn't want my list to not.
I was
be
wondering.
Long enough.
I was wondering how long it had been since you sat in front of someone who very awkwardly listed all of your accolades in front of you.
It doesn't feel awkward at all, and I actually am really enjoying it because,
dude. I mean,
especially
you have a lot
after lockdown.
Of.
After yeah. lockdown, like we really, Jenna, my wife, and we have two kids, but Jenna and I as artists really grew in an incredible way because we really realized like what we don't want to be doing and what we really want to be doing.
Yeah.
And art has just become life.
I want
to let you keep going with all that. But before we get too far, I have to put in there that aren't we all immigrants? Living in America.
I was waiting for you to say that.
Is that so cliche to say?
No, it's mad. It's as mad as it gets, you know.
I mean, it's just the truth.
It's true. No. Yeah, in that sense I could interview whoever I wanted because yeah, you know, we've all been immigrated to some
well,
place or another.
Yeah, I think it would only be interesting if that person knew their family tree DNA
which you do now. Which you
which
do now. I saw you. I see you setting yourself up for that.
Yeah.
But before we get to your recent obsession. Maddening obsession with your ancestry. Like I said, you've done all these really cool things. And we met, I think, 2011?
Yeah, I was going to say 12, but it was definitely 10, 11, or 12.
Something like 20s. That. Maybe, yeah, 10 or 11. And... Yeah, I was trying to think of like how we actually
I could tell you. I know how we met. I know how we met, Matt. I knew of you because you were doing an improv group at the University of New Orleans that at the time we were both at. I dropped out fairly soon after getting there.
After you saw my show.
Yeah, after I saw your show, I was like, this is not the place to be. If this is what they have to offer.
This is the best. This is the cream of the crop.
This is it. No, I actually, to be honest, yeah, you were. I was impressed by you and Danny Abel together. The rest of them can all
Danny
all,
is so
go,
funny.
You know,
Danny is
a
so funny.
Rotten hot dog, but yeah, Danny's incredible. But so I knew of you, and I was starting to meet some film people. All I did when I got to UNO was I did a bunch of theater. I did way too many drugs, had a psychotic meltdown, and had to drop out of school and get my shit back together so that I could be who I am, you know, years later. But before that psychotic meltdown, I knew that all of these filmmakers are very businesslike, and I don't want to be friends with them. All of these theater people are like very big dramatic fish in a small pond, which is New Orleans. I don't really want to be friends with them. Oh, these musicians. These guys are cool. Oh, Jordan Prince. Oh, I like that music. So what I did, desperate as it may be, or just a smart move, was I started throwing house shows at a very dilapidated house that me and three other filmmakers were living in. And the very first house show, I actually remember this, how I started to like ease my way in was I used to get very whiskey wasted back in those days. And I had gotten your number somehow. And I called you probably to talk about that show and left you like a ridiculous drunken voicemail to which you said something on some sort of social media thing like highlight of my day is waking up to a drunken voicemail from Matthew Martinez. I was like, all right, cool.
Oh,
he
man,
likes
I would
me,
kill
I like
to hear that. Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
I wish I still had that. Wow.
I wonder. I feel like I've had the same iPhone for 20 years. And then so what happened yeah. was I threw a house party and like posted it on social media, which I feel like you would never throw a party and just post it for the entire world of Facebook to come to your house, which like, I did because at the time, who gives a shit? And I asked if I think the first one was Big Lemoine. And
this wasn't the one that was filmed by Andrew.
No, that came down the line.
Yeah, that was much later.
The very first thing. And they got that idea from me, like, oh, wow, all these musicians. It was either like we did like a kind of an acoustic night where it was Jordan Prince acoustic with Sirens, now Hestina, Michelle Osman, and Kimberly Weiss. and it might have just been kind of like that. And then we kind of kept it open mic from there. And then it was such a fun fucking time. Everybody loved it. We kept doing it. And we'd have Big Lemois. We had Galley Nappers play at an Endymion party.
Oh, yeah.
That was wild as hell.
That's a really great memory, the Galley Nappers stuff.
For your listeners to understand, like, in New Orleans, we were on an avenue called Carrollton Avenue, which is a main strip. And
it's a very big road, yeah. It basically combines like a Esplanade right out of the French Quarter all the way uptown.
All the way uptown, huge road. All the interstates, and then like that area of the parade. It's kind of a sketchy thing to do. In my 30s now with kids, I would never throw a house party right there and just let any old stranger walk in off the streets. But at the time, and it turned into this beautiful mix of like, you know, college bros that were at the parade to all of our artsy fartsy fucking friends to random drunks off the street just coming in to get some food. And I remember we had a random drunk off the street come in and grab the mic and sing a song while Galley Nappers played.
I don't remember that.
It was a weird thing because then I got on the mic and started freestyling very aggressively towards this man that had come into my home. Which is like not cool because I'm the one that opened my doors for anyone to come in. But this weird thing came over me. Like I was upset that he came and stole the mic from you. And then it was just a very awkward, incredible memory of mine.
I think I do remember this party. Was it the one? I know there's some pictures that Ben Dude, who, for those who know the show, he was on like 4 or 5 episodes ago. He took some pictures from that party. I think I wore a hat that had these like styrofoam teeth on the brim, looked like a dog or a dinosaur, and I had
a
tan shirt, and there was a projector behind us, right, that played over our faces.
Yes.
I do remember that. I remember that concert because those pictures things.
I want you to believe that was the Endymion one. That was not the Endymion one. That was for Halloween.
That I knew it. That was a Halloween one much later.
He wanted to make it spooky, so he took you know, that movie with Red Rum.
Oh, The Shining.
The Shining, and he played it forwards, and then on top of that, he played it in reverse, and it was just kind of this very creepy, weird thing on y'all. Man, those were incredible parties.
Dude, those early 20 parties between the ages of 20 and 24 were single-handedly the best parties that I've still ever even remotely been connected to at all.
Yeah.
Like the best people, the best vibes, so much adventure happening at a party. You get pulled into, like, your friend says, oh, come here for a second, and it pulls you into like a hallway and tells you some crazy story about something some person did. Or, you know, in our case, someone's like, yo, someone just gave me these drugs of whatever variety, and you're like, oh, that's crazy. And you know that you're kind of secretive and it's like exciting, and your heart's racing.
It kind of felt safe. It felt safe at the same time because that was our house. It was our place.
Yeah.
Even
though everybody you spoke to, like, you're like, oh, that's Lee Garcia. Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, he's that drummer. Oh, he's cool. Or like, oh, Ben Matheny. Oh, he's this actor. And you started meeting all these people.
I still will meet people that if for some reason we start talking about it, they're like, oh, yeah, the Carrollton Banks parties. That's where I met so-and-so. Like, there are people in this arts community that
I think
threw down at those parties.
I was going to say,
it also was such a shithole. We were letting people do graffiti on the walls, and we were letting people like
crazy
do whatever they wanted in that place. So it was just art everywhere.
That house, I mean, I have so many memories connected to that first house on Carrollton. Not only these parties, but you know, you were part of this original collective. I guess I technically was too. EFI, which is it was like a small mm-hmm. independent film collective started by a few people who were, you know, UNO students. Mm-hmm. And you were in there. I think I was in there as a musician. You were in there as an actor. And we had this whole group of people who was like, all right, he's going to write, he's going to produce, you know, she's going to direct, whatever. Do you remember, I think the first, so for those who don't know, New Orleans every year has a 48-hour film fest. And you literally get 2 full days from agreeing to do it all the way to it needs to be a finished edited product. So yeah. You have conception, you have writers, you have a production team, you have to make your set, you have to make your story, act it, cut it, throw music on it. And I remember this one, I don't know if it was our buddy Mason Joyner who wrote one.
Mm-hmm.
We had so many friends in that group, like Mason Joyner, Susan Gordon, Corey Dumasnil, Will Assen, of course, Lee Garcia, Danny Abel, all these people together who pushed and created. I worked on it. I think at least I did 2 with EFI. Maybe it was 2011, 12, or 12, 13.
Yeah, I remember the very first one was called 5 Stages of Dan. Were you on that one?
Five Stages of Dan. Yeah.
Ben played 5 different versions of himself from like the past, present, future, and then like a female version of himself or a drag version.
I just remember the title.
And we filmed the title. We went and filmed at the restaurant that I owned for some terrible reason.
Oh, you still had Dockside at the time.
At that time, I don't know that I was technically the owner because it was all a shady thing, but I was working there because when I met you and started throwing those shows, that was post psychotic meltdown, post dropping out of UNO because I had my psychotic episode meltdown, went back to work at this restaurant that my brother had bought and with someone else's name on it, because in Louisiana, if you get caught selling weed when you're a teenager, you can't technically own anything or vote. And now none of that is law anymore. Now it's just legal for the most part.
I was going to say, wow. Okay. Yeah, there's so much to get into as well, because with this chapter of your life, I know it's hazy and tricky, so we can always cut things out later, but with Dockside.
Yeah, and also I'll let you say in Dockside, but if there's any moments that I'm like taking us way off track and it's like we don't need to go there, you cut me off, feel free.
No. But yeah, Dockside, you know, that was always a really interesting chapter of your life that I feel like I know a good bit about it now as, you know, years have gone by. But how did you, so like what Matt's trying to say, and I want you to tell the story yourself, of course, is like,
sure.
How did you end up at such a young age, basically being like the owner of a restaurant in?
Yeah, running a restaurant.
Where was it at? River Ridge.
It might have been Harahan, but River Ridge and Harahan are like these very two connected little, I guess, is that a suburb? I don't know. Basically, they're 2-3 miles from New Orleans. If you just follow the river, you get to these little areas that in the 1950s were farms, and now people live there.
So how did you get wrapped up in this restaurant?
So what happened was, so my older brother, who's 10 years older than me, that's what he did starting at like 14. He started working in the restaurant industry. Eventually, he became this like renowned chef and was like the youngest sous chef at a very well-known fancy restaurant on Bourbon Street. And he was working 15-hour days every single day, getting paid a very good amount of money, but he started having kids and he started realizing like, I don't ever see my kids. They're asleep when I get home. They're sometimes not even awake when I'm leaving for work. So this is my brother, he wanted to own his own restaurant so he could make his own hours. And that was just always a dream of his, to own his own restaurant. And so he found this restaurant called Dockside Seafood and Oyster Bar that had already existed for 30, 40 years before we got into it, and it was up for sale. And he asked a relative, an aunt's, you know, second husband, I don't know if that makes it for me, an uncle, asked them if he would be interested in investing because the guy had money. He said, sure, everything goes through. They're getting everything ready. Mark's going to own this restaurant. He's getting his team together. And that was when the local police were like, hey, so when you were 17, we caught you selling weed, but we didn't arrest you. So since we let you off there, we're not going to let you own a restaurant. And they were cool about it. They were like, so you're going to need to put somebody else's name on it.
They just told him to do that?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the story comes from him, my brother. So any story told by anyone in my family is, we're all storytellers. So it you know, believe the core of it, but the details are always exemplified onto the wall. So
yeah, I can imagine that.
So what happened was, he owned this restaurant, and different people would be like, all right, I don't want to be the owner anymore, and they'd put it in someone else's name. Then I had, around 1920, my first year of UNO, long story short, went to a psychiatrist that put me on, like, dangerous amounts of medicines for all these different sort of things. And that is something that runs in my bloodline. I have a first cousin who is schizophrenic. So, but really I was just depressed like every other, young adult in America. I don't know. I feel like maybe in Europe, maybe you all don't get.
No, it happens. But I know what you mean. Like, it's, I think our generation especially was really slapped in the face by enough reasons to feel depressed, and
right.
medications
and
as well.
The pharmacy industry, we were the testers for that. And it just, my parents didn't know any better, and they sent me to this lady who I actually recently found out that she gets her license, her medical license, revoked about every 5 years, and then gets it back another 5 years. Like, she's kind of a crook. And okay, she put me on, I basically went in there to be like, hey, I feel like despair, like I'm in a dark hole and I'll never get out of it. This is before I started college. And she said, okay, well, you're going to take Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant. You're going to take Abilify, which is a bipolar medicine. You're going to take Adderall to get you zoned in. And you're going to take Klonopin for when you want to go to sleep at night. And which maybe for somebody that could work. She said I was manic depressive, which I am pretty manic depressive. But what happened was, she told a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old that had just moved out of his parents' house, start at this low dose, take it for a week, go up to the next dose, take that for a week, and keep going up until you feel like you've hit the exact right chemical. And maybe some people in other parts of the world or in earlier decades at 19 or 18 were grown-ass fucking men fighting in world wars. But for millennials at 18 and 19, we're still little bitty babies.
Totally.
And
totally.
So I was like, oh, yeah, stunted. Fucking right. I went to the highest level of every single one. And
immediately.
I did the week process, but once I got to the top of the top, I was like, hell yeah. And then, so the psychiatrist, who's a crook, was like, she was like, oh, okay. So then eventually I started wigging out, and I'm telling her like I'm hallucinating. I'm seeing things. I'm hearing things that aren't there. And she was like, you're schizophrenic. You need to up your doses of your medicines.
Oh my God.
And because I have a first cousin who is schizophrenic and is homeless, and if we want to go there, is I see him in my neighborhood every so often because this is the neighborhood he grew up in, and he's just a homeless schizophrenic wandering the streets. And but he wouldn't recognize me if he sees me because his eyes are just zonked out. So because of Al, my cousin, my family thought, okay, well, 18, 19, 20, that's about the age when schizophrenia would set in. Matthew is schizophrenic.
Right. You had these reasons to believe, like, this right. is actually happening.
This
now.
Actually could be a real thing.
Yeah.
And so I kind of kept it going like that for maybe a year, maybe 2 years. And then the hallucinations stopped being fun. It used to be cool to be able to stare at a wall and the beams would bend and you could feel like you're twirling them and bending them with your eyes. Or it got bad to where I was hearing other voices messing with my head. And then I started seeing actual terrifying things. And I got like, you know what, fuck it, all of this medicine. And I just went off of all of it, cold fucking turkey, laid on my bed, my sofa that I was living in my first little apartment to myself for probably a month until my brother was like, dude, come wash dishes for me at Dockside. Just keep your head down. All of these medicines this lady put you on are going to get out of your system and you'll find yourself again. You'll get yourself back. Well, that's what happened. I started washing dishes. I'm slowly getting back to who Matthew is before all of this crazy medicine got put into my bloodstream for a couple of years. And then I'm like, oh, fuck, this is also in my bloodline to be a chef. I'm Cajun as hell. My brother's a chef. My uncle's a chef. My grandfather was a chef. Like, let me get on the line. So then I start cooking, and I'm like, oh, I'm really good at this. And so then after a year or two, I'm the head chef in this restaurant.
Wow. That's running. Crazy how that lines up from where you started.
From where I started to that. And it's that's crazy. And I still love to cook, and I easily could have stuck with that path. And then eventually what happened was all the owners didn't want to be a part of it. A choo-choo train's coming. I'm curious if it'll all play through, but
it sounds like you almost just had a hallucination there for a second.
Yeah. I'm fine now. All right, so now.
Then check this out. Then I was head chef at a restaurant, right? And then
the choo-choo train came right through. And then I flipped on the pancake to get upside to the clouds that would get me inside of the oil spot of the train. And my brother came to me and he was like, look, we don't have anybody else that wants to own the restaurant. You have a clean record. Will you just put your name on it? I'll still be the actual owner, but the technicality will be no one will know, blah, blah, blah. And everyone in my life, my parents, my friends said, dude, do not put your fucking name on a restaurant. And at the time, I felt like I owed my brother to do that because he helped me get out of this.
He cleaned you up.
He cleaned me up, and no one else really had the answer for me at the time.
No one else had taken that step towards you and said, hey, something's wrong. Yeah, let me help you.
Yeah, people had their thoughts of what would help, but
it's understandable. Yeah. Like, you also have this doctor who no one knows is a quack yet. So they're thinking like, oh, well, you know, he does have that cousin, and the doctor is saying he's got to up the dose, so.
Right.
You know, poor Matthew.
And right about the time that I just got off all that medicine, that doctor just disappeared.
Wow.
And it was like, it was something crazy, like their secretary told us that she had to go get a back surgery in Africa or something fucking bizarre.
What?
So I thought I
as
owed
one
this
does.
To my brother. And yeah, that's where you get a good back surgery is in Africa. It's a known thing. Don't
dispute it. It's the best one, of course.
And so I put my name on this restaurant. And then sure enough, the tax man called me the next day like, hey, I see you're the new owner. By the way, in 2000 something, you didn't pay your taxes. And then so then I'm like owner of this restaurant for a year, maybe two. Dealing with the IRS the entire time. A federal police officer kept calling me and then eventually wanted to meet up with me because he thought it was like some shady shit. Like, we had some sort of drug ring happening out of the back door or whatever. And it came down to a moment where I looked at him and I said, what would we even be doing? And he said, well, I don't know. You tell me. And I said, I'll tell you that we're just two fucking idiots who thought we could run a restaurant and it's burning to the ground right now and we all want out. And he believed me, and that was the truth. And then, like, not that long after, we sold that shit, got out of it, and everyone moved on with their lives. And I went back to
oh my god, that's hilarious,
to the world of acting, which I knew at that time, before I knew I was going to get out of the restaurant, I had gone from the schizophrenic mess to clean to a very serious opiate addict that I lived with a drug dealer that would sell very strong painkillers, and I just was miserable and would live my life working 15-hour days in a restaurant with very pirate-esque people, just hardly would eat, went down. I weigh 175 pounds. That's my, like, normal weight. I was 115 pounds. I was just like, this is me. Fuck it. I'm a drug addict that runs a restaurant. I don't give a shit.
You just accepted it.
I just accepted it, yeah. And thank God it didn't happen. And that's how things are supposed to happen. But man,
that's such a wild life.
Yeah, that's such a lifetime ago.
I mean, you were pretty much, I mean, I didn't know that at the time I met you at the EFI house that you were still, like, connected enough to Dockside for people could shoot the 48-hour film there. I didn't know that.
Right. At that point in time, I wasn't the technical owner, but I was running the kitchen, so it was easy enough. I had the keys to the place. Yeah.
Crazy. I thought by the time that we met, that was already done, but I guess when I first met you, you were still there. Do you remember like the last year that you finally said, okay, I'm done, I'm out, it's over?
When we sold Dockside, man. Yeah.
Do you think it's like 2012?
No. How old were we in 2012?
I was
22. How old are you right now?
31.
How old are you right? You're 31. I'm 33. I met Jenna when I was 25. So I was like 24. So 33.
So you're 2 years 24. Older. So it was,
so 9
years ago. Yeah,
2012.
Yeah. Right,
man.
If I was 2012, I was 22. You're 2 years older.
What year are we in right now? 2022.
2022. So I turned 32 this year.
No, yeah. So it was 2013 that we sold Dockside, if not 2014.
Crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, fucking wild story. It's a great
story. Dude, 2013, man. We were like full on connected as friends by 2013, and I had no idea you were still at Dockside. You always talked about it in the past tense.
I know. Yeah, what's bizarre is, like, because when we were like super super duper buddy buddy all the time, you were working at Rue and I was landscaping.
Yeah, that was your thing. You were a landscaper and an actor, like, that's right. All that you ever,
and so maybe
that was your thing,
right? So I had just gotten out of the restaurant and wanted a job working outside, so I started landscaping.
That's crazy. Okay. So you left Dockside, and then you had quit school. So when, like, you had these friends, you had these connections in New Orleans.
When did things start popping off?
Yeah, like, you know, well, first off, have you always, I guess not, because you just said that you had a phase where you believed, not now I'm a drug addict who runs a restaurant, but was there a time where you told yourself, you know, one of these epiphany style moments where you're kind of looking in the mirror or out to the stars and go, like, man, I really, really want to be an actor.
Yes.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I've known I was going to be an actor. I did theater in high school and loved it, and was lucky enough to have this theater director who had come to our school from Broadway. He was like this child. He was an immigrant from Guatemala or something like that, and And he came to America, North America, was a dancer, and started winning these contests that eventually put him on a Broadway play in New York as part of the dance entourage, or whatever you call that. And from there, he had these bigger roles on Broadway, all as a teenager, and then came to the school, the high school that I went to and did theater, as an 18-year-old man to be their first year of their school opening theater director. And he was this like incredible, to say it short and quickly, like there was the United States competitions that high schools would go put on plays and stuff, and it would be this thing, best monologue, best play, best this,
oh,
best
really?
That. And they won something silly like 10 years in a row, and they actually asked them a few years before I started going there, like, hey, do you guys mind sitting out some of the things?
Some of the competitions?
Yeah, I'm sorry. One second.
Bruh. What's going right. on? What was that about?
Dude, so Noah is a 5-year-old. He's about to be a 6-year-old. He's going through some stuff in school, and he's just been super emotional lately. And we also have a 1-year-old. And sometimes at bedtime lately, he gets like... He just gets wild as hell because he's so tired, and he gets so wild, and he pushes and pushes and pushes until mama has to yell at him. And apparently there was something that happened where her elbow bonked him in the face, or she hit him or something.
She just showed him, you know, who's boss. And
right. And so that's why he was crying frantically. And I'm in my garage, which I guess no one can see, but it's super cool.
It's actually, it looks really, really cozy.
Have you not seen it?
I was in there one time in this, when I had my breakdown visit in June last year. I was there one time. I stayed there. I stayed at your house.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and the garage was nothing like it is now.
Yeah, I just saw it like Jenna was doing laundry in there, so I came out with you. And
we have this like incredible keyboard, big ass keyboard that my sister's school was just throwing away because they thought it didn't work, but really they just needed to plug it into a power source. And so she was just like, yeah, go ahead, take it.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. I think what we were talking about is that you had done theater in high school and you'd loved it, and you had this teacher.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'm going to take a little bit of vitamin C.
You got to stay healthy. I mean, as a parent, especially around all these kids going to school, I have so many friends who are dads now. Still not as many as I'd like. It feels like when you're a parent, you just seem to realize everyone who isn't. And you know that best of all because you were the very first one in our friend group who was a parent. And you must have felt that for a really long time.
Well,
as the only guy.
You're the only...
I'm the only other one from that original group, right?
Yeah, and even still, like, out of the artists that we're friends with, my sweet, sweet sister from another mother and father, although both being Cajuns, we could easily be related. Julie O'Dell,
right? Julie O'Dell,
over the past
yeah.
years have become very, very close friends.
She's an extremely talented singer-songrowriter. I'd love to have her on sometime.
Oh,
I could pick her brain about her some stuff. She's really great. Man.
And yeah, if y'all haven't heard Julie O'Dell's music, you definitely
Yeah, big recommendation there. Go to Julie IE and then ODELL. She's really something else, man. I'm just waiting for the day for that to really I thought she would have popped about 5 years ago, actually.
Yeah, well, she had a kid and having kids puts things on hold, but she did recently sign to a really good manager, and she has an incredible album that is coming out soon. And she actually will be in France.
Oh, she's playing some shows
in
abroad.
November. Yeah, she's got a little European tour about to happen.
Would you look at that? Oh, maybe. Well, maybe I can contact her. You know, you have her number, I'm guessing, right?
Hell yeah.
Maybe I.
Well,
maybe
you're
I can
coming.
Get,
yeah,
I was gonna say I'm coming there. I'm coming there in another week or two. But maybe I'll steal her number from you and ask her if when she's in Europe if she wants to.
Yeah,
do the
for
show
sure.
And
no,
it.
We'll bring that up while you're here, anyways, because I'm sure she would love to hear all kinds of tips about where to play while you're in Europe.
Oh man, a friend of mine wrote me this girl Catherine that I worked with at this elementary school. And she wrote, it was kind of a funny feeling. She wrote me a few days ago and she said, "Hey, I hope you're doing well. We haven't caught up in a while. I have a date coming." I forgot to write her back actually, but she's like, "I have a date coming up and, you would be the person I would know who might know like what shows are going on. I want to see a concert, like what's happening." And honestly, I feel like I've never been more outside the loop.
Oh, yeah.
Than I am right now, you know, like
oh,
2 years of nothing, you know, yeah. And then like, like you said, then, family slows everything yeah. down. So I don't know anything that's going on.
What's the wildest anything. Thing about being an artist in any field, whether it's film and TV or music, is that when you're in those stages of keeping humans alive, which it's so stupid that they come out so soon. Like a fucking elephant comes out and can walk. A human comes out and it takes yeah. a fucking year to learn how to stand
on its own feet.
They
don't know how to do. They can't even blow their nose, man.
They
You're
still
like,
can't.
Clear out your sinuses.
Yeah, fucking figure can't. Out the problem and get it together, you selfish, worthless little larva. What the fuck? Get your shit together. Grow up.
Learn already.
Right.
God.
But yeah, it puts shit on hold, and that's what a lot of artists don't have kids, I think, because of the fear of it putting what they see as their trajectory as an artist. And it does. It 100% changes everything. But if you're an artist and that's what you'll be, you will always be that, and you just I don't know if I found my way or it just all the pieces fell into place, but Jenna and I both as artists have figured out how to make it not only work but thrive, and we're still figuring it out, but you know.
Of course, yeah.
We pat ourselves on the back every so often when we're like so exhausted from raising a six-year-old who acts like he's 30 years old because he grew up around a bunch of artists who talked to him like he was a grown man.
Yeah, and man, your son has got the funniest way of talking of dude, any kid his age I've ever met.
I had to talk to his teacher because he got kind of in trouble about a little thing that happened very recently. I talked to her earlier tonight, and one of the things she was like, he has a very mature sense of humor. And she was like, I don't mean he curses or makes dick jokes. She was like, his sense of humor is just like, that's even how it was when he was in this little preschool. Like the two grown-ups that ran this little six kid thing in their backyard and growing vegetables and shit, hippy dippy stuff. They were like, dude, Noah cracks jokes that make us laugh. And these other little stupid larvas are like, oh, we don't get it. But that's what happens when you're raised around a bunch of storytellers.
What do you imagine Noah's gonna do,
man?
Professionally,
he really is going to have the potential to do a lot of things, and it's not at all even me just being a proud dad, because he definitely like he won't be a football player. It's not like, yeah, he's gonna be a big, he's strong, yeah. Well, he
no, I don't see that. I don't see
he
that
wants to be an actor, and inside I'm like, please don't be a fucking actor. It's so
right,
so much
So you don't want the competition.
Neglection. Yeah, I don't want the competition. But yeah, exactly. He's just been saying that for a while, and like he memorizes my lines and shit like that. And he actually is
That's sweet.
Really good at it. His little kindergarten theater teacher pulled me aside to say, "Hey, I don't say this a lot. Like my kid, I'm a theater, like I'm an actor and my husband's an actor. Our kid can't do shit if he's standing on a stage, but your son like actually move my mic actually knows how to take direction, and he just there's something special about that because
he's been around it so much.
Since he was little.
I could really see that for him. I think Iris is still a mystery, of course, and with ours it's the same feeling where I told a buddy of mine back before they were born what was going down. They're like, "Hey, by the way, this is happening."
Yeah.
And he's like one of my oldest friends from high school, and he was like, "You know, with a screenwriter mom and like a musician entertainer dad, that's going to be the coolest pair of kids in the whole world." And I said, "Well, actually, we kind of believe that they're going to like think we're big losers and go right into accounting." And they're like, right. "Dude, the two coolest accountants you've ever seen."
That's so funny because I have said before, like, I just hope he's an accountant and somebody really banker, boring. Man.
Rake it in and buy dad a house.
Right. He might be an accountant or a banker, or your kids might be accountant, but they'll be fucking cool. So much cooler. Dude, I meet kids. Wait till your kids are in school and you meet these other kids and you're like, "You fucking dweeb. You're such a loser." The fuck out of my kid's face.
Oh my god,
that's a whole nother world. Once your kids start making friends, and then you have to meet those parents, and it's
what are the parents like that you marry? Are they mostly cool, or do you find the people that you get stuck with?
I straight up have left the house when Noah made a friend that he made this is before he was in school, made a little friend at a playground. The parents wanted to try to make it be a thing, and they were so probably lovely people, but they were so boring that they came to our house while their kids played, and the four of us, me and Jenna and the woman, studied Egyptian temples, which that was extremely interesting. And then the dad was just like, "Oh." And it was so hard that I couldn't stay. And I actually faked a phone call and said, "Guys, I got to go help somebody with some kind of something, blah, blah, blah," and left. And left Jenna with them. And then
That's
came
hard,
home that
man.
Night. And Jenna was like, "Yo, bro, you just left me with them." And she was like, "And I knew you were lying. You just left me with them." And I was like, "I'm sorry. I refuse to foster and grow friendships with people I don't want to be friends with just because our kids want to be friends."
Right, right. I feel so lucky that the most dedicated listener of the show, actually, besides my mom, is a good friend of mine. Shout out to you, Moritz.
Lawrence.
He is Lawrence. No, Moritz. Moritz.
Moritz? Oh, Moritz.
Yeah, not Mo Bat, producer, not the co-host.
Yeah,
but
I know Mo.
There's another Moritz who is originally met. Like I met him through Ify. He's also a screenwriter.
Hell yeah, Moritz.
He's
Am I saying
hella.
His name right?
Yeah, Moritz.
Okay, yeah.
Moritz Bart.
Cool.
Moritz,
so what? Like Moritz, he's got Moritz. Kids. He's got kids.
Yeah, he's got two beautiful, wonderful little girls, and. I'm really lucky that he and I are good friends, and that our families are good friends, because, you know, I don't know how the kids will click. I really hope they do, because I want that to be like a bond where we can like take vacations together
right.
down the road and stuff. But that's
What's the
like
age
the
difference?
Only his oldest. I hope he forgives me for not maybe getting it perfectly right. I think his oldest is 3.
Yeah, you don't have to get that right. Between 1 and 7 is like
is a blur.
Yeah, they're a larva. They are obnoxious. Or no, they're a larva, then they're cute, then they're way too much. And then from then on out, you got to memorize the
She's either three or she's six, and I'm way behind. And then he has another little girl who is about a year, a little less than a
year.
That's
incredible. Oh, yeah. And those little girls are going to sync up. Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And they're going to love, like, playing with your little Oscar and Lainey and you know, being, especially the younger of Moritz's kids are going to love playing big sister to your kids, because that's what
his oldest, especially, she's a hoot, man. I'm a big fan. But yeah, that's like, you know, very lucky that there's at least one family friend that will link up, because I know it's like you say, when they start going to school and stuff, you're going to have to meet the other people, and you can just only hope that they're cool. I'm so anxious about that, because being in Germany, you know, I'm going to have to hope that whoever I get matched up with for park dates or play dates or sleepovers are people that are cool enough to maybe want to speak English, which is so biased of me, but I don't know. Of course, I know that I have to get better at German and be more confident with it, but there's something about being trapped or stuck or put together with people that, especially if they just kind of, if they have this attitude of like, ah, but come on, you know, you're here, let's do it. Then I don't like the challenge, you know?
Yeah. The challenge of meeting your kids' friends' parents is a challenge enough. Trying to have a conversation, yeah, even if you speak the same language.
What you doing there?
Sorry, I'm trying to figure out the charger on this laptop. I have it here. I'm grabbing the wrong cords.
Oh, okay. But no, we got a little off topic there. But basically, yeah, you knew since high school that you wanted to do that. I think I never really asked you who, and then this is probably a really boring question, but it's my show. Mm-hmm. It's like, who is a handful of actors, like current or past, that, you know, really get under your skin, where you are so in anticipating their projects and
that I love them, right?
You just love them, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Nick Cage, right off the
that
top.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, Nick Cage. Let me plug this charger in real quick. Nick Cage, Willem Dafoe.
That makes a lot of sense, too. Yeah, I think he's probably one of the greatest actors ever.
Yeah, anything Christopher Walken is in, I definitely will.
This is the best list. All right. Christopher Walken, Nick Cage, John Travolta.
John Travolta.
Mickey Rourke.
definitely. And then, like, yeah, like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino.
Of course,
because I'm a big sucker for all of those Italian monster movies, all the Scorsese ones he did with them and stuff.
Of course. Do you like that movie Heat?
I have not watched Heat enough. I watched Heat when I was a young boy, and I think that I liked it at the time. I think it went over my head, but it's not something. Mm-hmm. I'm very glad that you brought that up, because I'm gonna go watch it and rewatch it 10 more times.
I had always heard about Heat, and I had never seen it. And then last year, I guess it was early last year, it was one of the last times I remember having the house to myself for a weekend. And I always took advantage of that. It was always my movie weekends, and I'd watch all the stuff.
I love that.
That if he doesn't like, you know, I'd watch the whole right. John Wick trilogy and Lord of the Rings, whatever, deluxe edition, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And finally, one weekend, I was like, you know what I haven't seen? I haven't seen Heat. And I love Pacino. I love De Niro. I think it's a Michael Mann film. I was like, oh, Val Kilmer's in this. This could be really cool. And I put it on. And I cannot remember, like, loving a movie so quickly.
Oh, wow.
It's so good.
Oh, wow. And I can't believe it was.
No, it was so. I'm so surprised that nobody. It didn't win anything. It just kind of came and went.
Right.
But it's. like De Niro is so restricted and so subtle and so controlled in that movie. And then you got Pacino, who is like playing the perfect Pacino.
Right.
You got that scene where he says like, she's got a big ass and your head's right up it.
That's hysterical. I don't remember any of that, but that was a great Pacino thing. Yeah. You know what you just made me think of? Also John Goodman.
Oh,
John
yeah.
Goodman and John Turturro.
Oh, great. Yeah. Great choices.
John Goodman, what you made me think of talking about control, John Goodman and the Big Lebowski, every single breath that he takes is mm-hmm. fucking gold.
Dude, he's so great in that.
Dude.
Do you think you have more of a leading man vibe, or would you rather be like one of the greatest character actors?
You know what's funny is that, so when I just to get us up to this point, we were saying I did theater in high school, jumped into acting and film in college, had my meltdown, went to work at the restaurant and thought, fuck it, I'll never be an actor again. When I got out of that, somebody was like, dude, you're a fucking actor, get back into it. Got me an agent, and I held on to that agent way too long. She, bless her heart, was like, got me some things, but just wasn't getting me. She wasn't in the same state as me. And then right before the pandemic hit, I signed with Rebecca Davis of the Crew Collective, who manages Second Line Stages, which is one of the biggest stages in New Orleans that films happen, and she's just been managing it for years. So I've been seeing her for 12 years going in for auditions, and the vibe was so right, it was so perfect. I knew immediately, like, all right, shit's gonna start popping off with her. And right away things were popping off, and then the pandemic hit, lockdown, so then we just kind of kept mm-hmm. close throughout it. But since then I've been very happy with the work that I'm getting. But to bring us back to what you just asked,
originally, yeah, it was good to recap because we did miss that.
Yeah, for sure. But originally, when I got with her, I said, I'm not a leading man. I'm the villain in the movie. I'm the character in the movie. And now I'm starting to realize that I actually, when you get to know who I am as an actual human person, am not evil. And
not at all.
You like kind of really look into my eyes, you're like, oh, you're too nice. So like if it was a villain type of character, it'd have to be somebody that is also struggling with the villainous shit they're doing.
Yeah, nuanced villain.
So I guess when I say like, oh, I could play the leading man, is if the leading man is a character.
Right. That that's sense? Perfect that you have like Walken and Cage.
Right.
Goodman, because they are big, boisterous characters.
Exactly. They're never just themselves, and they are at the same time. But yeah, that's where I would like to see myself progressing towards. Willem Dafoe, yeah.
Man. He's kind of someone who I think slithered pretty, he still does it pretty seamlessly in between a supporting, strong, like, intense
right.
character.
That's what you just made me think of.
You know, like for example, with the role he plays, let's just say in Grand Budapest Hotel,
right?
Over into something that's like demanding and intense, like The Lighthouse, and then back into side characters. I want to say something like Platoon.
Yeah, what
and then
was,
back.
Oh yeah,
you know,
Platoon.
He snakes in and out, or like the Lars von Trier film, not Melancholia, but Antichrist.
Right.
Goes into something like really nuanced and subtle and artistic like that. And he's just the greatest.
You know what is my favorite Willem Dafoe bit part, you know, day player, side role, is there was a movie called Existence.
I don't know that
like
one.
Like Existence, but with a Z. It was a sci-fi movie that came out in 1999. And it had Jude Law, and it was a David Cronenberg movie.
Oh, really?
And it had Jude Law, and then Jennifer Jason Leigh, I don't know. She's just this
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's
so
great.
Yeah, it's this, it's like this incredible sci-fi movie, but Willem Dafoe plays this gas station clerk in it, and it's just, it's so good. It's so
good. Man.
So yeah, those are the roles I want.
On the poster, it even says it says all the names, and then it says and Willem Dafoe as Gas.
Yeah, I think that was probably their big selling point, because I think it was early in Jude Law and
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Jennifer Jason Leigh. Maybe I could be wrong. Yeah, that's a great one.
Play it. Great one. Kill for it,
dude. Out of sci-fi movies. If you said, all right,
I never heard
what
of this.
Sci-fi movie are we going to watch right now and not be like blown away, like as if you're watching
The Matrix or something.
The Matrix, right. But just enjoyable from beginning to end, and it's very weird worlds you go into. Tell me a little bit
about Mama's Little Bus Driver.
So, yeah, those are, so we, there's Mama's Little Bus Driver and Mama's Little Orphanage. Those are some short films that I wrote and directed. And I was an actor, but I was always a writer. I just never went to film school and I thought in our early days, like, because the University of New Orleans, because kids getting out of film school have that exact mold and language that they have to work in, or else, you know, does that make sense?
Right.
Like when you get older,
they beat these structures into them.
Yeah. And when you get older, you find really great film sets is a hodgepodge of people that are just like, yeah, some went to film school, and some just learned to make movies, and you learn the lingo on your way, and
just like at any job. Yeah,
right. And so really I made Mama's Little Bus Driver out of like a, I had just had Noah Martin was one, I think he was a one-year-old, and I was feeling stagnant and was like, I need to do something. And I had this idea in my head that had been there for years, and also I need to prove to this group of friends that are all making short films together that, hey, even though I didn't go to film school, like, I can make a moment in time encapsulated in a movie in my own voice and in my own way. And so we made Mama's Little Bus Driver, which is really thrown together, but it's a extremely absurd world.
How would you describe, if you were trying to explain the genre?
If I had to say the style, I would say,
because it does blend a lot of things.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely
like when you wrote it, what was the point of, like, I want to make people laugh, or was it I want to create something artistic?
You know what it was? I wanted to make something that somewhat showed the perspective someone who is schizophrenic or heavily bipolar manic. I wanted to create something that showed their perspective on what we call reality. And that to me was what it was. I was making, it could have been any piece of art. I decided it was going to be a short film, and I was going to make a story of this schizophrenic man who was played by Ben Matheny. I think his character in Mama's Little Bus Driver was Buddy, and it was a grown man who's dressed like a kid who's talking straight to the camera as though it's like this
like documentary
Mr. Rogers
style.
Yeah, it was like a Mr. Rogers show on acid.
Mr. Rogers is better.
Yeah, and he has like this bus he made in his backyard, and in his head, it's a real bus, and he's a bus driver, and he has these actual guests or patrons that come onto his bus that he's made who are really just figments of his hallucinations. And there were some different little themes that were trying to be pushed in there about kind of when you're in that state of mind. It also was pushing how I was grappling with, as an artist, can you make art if you're stable? I had this thought that I have to be manic, I have to be schizo, I have to be depressed, I have to be pulling from this well of sadness to create art, because at the time that's all I knew. And Jenna, my wife, who we had a one-year-old with, who is totally in the light of life and makes beautiful art, was trying to show to me at the time, if making art of any form is inside of you, it doesn't matter if you're at the bottom pit of despair or if you are appreciating every moment of life. But it is something that you have to get used to. You have to get used to just like having kids and still making art. If you go from being at the bottom pit of despair and that's how you made art, to then make art while being happy, is like you have to learn. There's an adjustment period. So that was kind of, and so.
But that's good advice. That's good advice from her part too.
Oh.
You know, to say that no creativity needs to be locked down from one perspective, that if it's in the you, it's going to get made
100
either way.
And you could totally say that the greatest artists of our times, not all of them.
Not everybody's a Hemingway type, you know?
Yeah, I don't even know. What was he, just a drunk pervert?
I don't know about, maybe he was a pervert, but like a drunk depressive, you know, killed himself.
Right, that's what I thought of, like Da Vinci, not Da Vinci, who...
Van Gogh, right?
Van Gogh, yeah, like he was schizo, he was bipolar, if that type of artist were able to stabilize and then keep making art, it would change their art, but it would still be this beautiful art. Not to even for a second compare myself to Van Gogh, but those were like the themes in my head. But when you watch the movie, it is the best thing anyone's ever said after watching Mama's Little Bus Driver was they looked over and said, "What is wrong with you?"
That's amazing.
And that was like, that was at the time, that's what I wanted people to watch that and think, "What the fuck?" And then we went over.
I think
over,
it's great. Yeah,
I love it. I love it.
I love it, man. Yeah. It's like a great. Is that on YouTube for people to watch?
It isn't, but I'm gonna put both of them up.
I was going to ask because, you know, for this, anything that you want to link to put in the show notes, you should send me, because if Mama's Little Bus Driver is somewhere on some link like Vimeo or YouTube, then we can put in the link.
Yeah, there's definitely both Vimeo links that are private, but I'm going to go ahead and this, I'm going to make them public and just start my own. What do you make, a Vimeo page like you would make a YouTube page?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I never made one, but I imagine it's pretty similar.
That's what I need to do. I need to have my own space where my creations are. And then Mama's Little Orphanage.
I always thought you should have your own YouTube channel.
Right, and I would like to do that, but if they are Vimeo links, what is that, an ordeal where you just have to turn them into
YouTube
links?
Who has the Vimeo pages?
Bruno.
Are they Bruno's?
Bruno Doria, Worklight.
Just check to see if they're... well, I guess you should...
They're not
ask
like
him, but.
Well, of course they're not. He would give them to me. They're not.
I was gonna say, just download them.
You can't go on his Vimeo and find them. We never release them.
Yeah,
for
I mean
they're
your babies, so you can just say, "Hey, I'm gonna download these from the Vimeo link and put them on YouTube."
And then most recently, we shot it right before the pandemic, edited it during the pandemic. Was Mama's Little Orphanage, and that was like production.
That was a step up.
And dude, that movie, I submitted it to New Orleans Film Festival, and it played there. And then I just didn't care to submit it anywhere else, but it definitely...
I think you should have, man. It's definitely a huge, like, professional accomplishment.
Yeah.
Like,
for
up,
sure.
You know?
And, like, the crew, like, what we built was just incredible.
The set
was so incredible. I mean, we had a wall of TVs, 20 TVs by 7, I think the stack was.
Unbelievable.
Playing archive footage, home videos of people ranging from the 30s to the 90s. Like we went and got
these
old reel-to-reel shit to digitize. And that was the kind of the story of that, was these grown men who are stuck as childs in their old orphanage that they lived in, and mama no longer existed, but in their madness, mad scientist way, they had figured out a way to turn VHS tapes into somewhat sentient beings, to where if I had Bobby Charles home video and I had Tommy Lee, that's a real person though, home video, they could...
I was gonna say Bobby Charles is too.
Yes, yeah, so who's Bobby Charles?
He's a musician.
Oh, crazy. He's also a bartender at BJ's. But they could...
If they had like a John Doe tape or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, right. They had this weird way of finagling these tapes through this crazy thing we built, and they were able to play them on two separate TVs, and those two little kids who maybe had died 70 years ago could interact somehow through the TVs to each other. And then the whole plot of the movie was these two boys trying to make a tape of themselves to go play it in front of their deceased mother so that they could say hi to mama.
It's really sweet, man. It's a really heartwarming story, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Bus driver ends very dark, and mama's orphanage ends very sweet. And so we might get to making more mamas in the future. It's definitely like...
I would love that, man. It's your passion project.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
I love
that should
it.
Keep going.
It would get very revamped. Just we had the same cast for the first two, and it's just those guys, we're not very we don't really work together anymore, and I think it would just get changed to where the casts were more interesting, the three, or who, you know, mom or whatever it is, but I think I have figured out that something that I feel very closely tied to is what it is to be schizophrenic or mentally unstable, especially in the United Snakes of America, because the schizophrenics and the mentally unstable here are not taken care of. The homeless are actually surprisingly really taken care of in New Orleans. They all have very nice tents that the city of New Orleans has given them, and when there's a freeze or a storm, they make sure they go round them up and bring them all to a shelter for that overnight, and they just let them be. And there's like an odd respect between the homeless population in New Orleans and New Orleans Police Department and the city of New Orleans that I've never seen in other cities. They're not really treated as...
I didn't even know that about the tents and the shelter driving. That's really amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I worked on something recently that the, I don't know who it was in the van ride over to the set from LA was like, I am astounded at how well... He was like, y'all have like city-owned trash cans, like by like, if there's a row of 75 tents, there's a trash can every 10 tents, and the city of New Orleans is going and taking the trash out. Like they understand, I guess, that they can't solve the homeless problem, but the least they can do is treat them like human beings.
Like the people they are.
Yeah. And that's,
That's really good.
Yeah, I only feel tied to the mentally unstable who become homeless because my cousin who I grew up with is not being taken care of, and I see him, but he's also aggressive and violent, so I can't help him even if I wanted to. So it makes
you think about that.
It makes me think about the homeless. But the schizophrenia, because I went through a phase of medicated induced schizophrenia, which I consider myself manic depressive 100%, and could easily be pushed into a schizophrenic state of mind. So I can relate to it all. And the last thing I'll say on all of that is there is a place in the mental world of someone who is schizophrenic or bipolar or manic depressive that when you are having an episode, you feel like I can't go out into the public because I can't show myself to the public because they won't accept me, and that will crush my soul. But at the same time, I need to go around people to remind me, to help me get back my feet back down on earth. And so it's this ugly cycle of not being able to get out. And then eventually for some, that phase passes. And then you kind of, if you're lucky like myself, you have very close friends who know you and know to kind of be nurturing towards you, and I can openly say to my friends, I'm coming out of this phase, and they'll know. Like, it's like with anyone that can be boiled down to the most simple thing of having a very close friend that you can say, I've been super bummed for a week. And when you come out of that shell, they're not like, hey, let's talk about how happy and wonderful life is or whatever.
I know exactly that feeling. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's always something that we found in our friend groups, was that we were always able to communicate what we're going through without bias or without reciprocation, without repercussion. I mean, and just having them not just try and bury it and say like, well, come on, you're over it, it's all fine now, but more of like, What do you need? Yeah, and that's so much more important.
And that was huge. That was huge. I'll say one more thing on this. That was huge for, like, when I met you, and then you introduced me to Vivi and Matt and that group, because I was raised in, like, a lot of men, I guess, around the world to not cry and not show your feelings. And to meet this group of friends that were so
all about feelings.
All about your feelings and your emotions, and it makes it so that you can, I want to say get them out of the way, but that's not what I mean.
Face them and accept them.
Move to the next thing. Exactly. You can't grow until you face that shit. Which is funny because I'm sorry. One of my tricks in my bag of acting that I've been wanting to obtain, and I've been working on it, is to be able to cry on command. And I was in a film recently that the scene made me realize what it is, abandonment, that made me cry. And I was like, wow, this is happening. I can cry in these scenes and then sing Scooby Dooby Doo, Where Are You, when the scene is over, because of like friends like you and the group that I had that and my wife Jenna, really, who pointed out to me that because I had a whole group of friends prior to my real friends that when I started having schizophrenic episodes abandoned me, basically, you know, they because they didn't understand it or whatever it is. I have no blame or anything for them, but I work through that enough to where now I know, okay, if I'm on set and I want to cry on command, I can just think of what I can just hold on to that feeling or that old fear of mine of being abandoned for being a mess of any sort, and just kind of hold on to that, and eventually just natural tears can come out. But because I've worked through it and I'm past it, it's not like then they're saying cut and then I'm a fucking emotional
and then
wreck.
You're suffering,
right?
But yeah, it's like a well that's there that now you have the strength to be able to tap into,
yeah,
and then release from.
Yeah, it's a wild thing. And I've always heard from other actors, like, yeah, I just think about my kids dying and then I cry. And I'm like, that doesn't do it for me.
That's horrible. That's hard, man.
Yeah, that's rough, but it would just wouldn't do
it for me. I think it's healthier. It's healthier to have this thing that you can, you know, tap into in a healthy way. And that's something that I always loved about our friend group is this ability to, like, even if we don't talk as much, all of us collectively as we used to a few years ago, there's still this sort of thing of like not quite letting go, you know, enough.
Right.
Like it's still like wondering, even if we don't write each other or call each other, still wondering like, how are they? Kind of
right.
Like, I hope he's doing good. Or like, yeah, oh, I heard he got that job. Or like, oh,
right,
I hope he, you know.
Yeah. VV,
just
George,
still kind of,
Matt, Pats, you. I see all of y'all so much less than we used to because everyone's busy trying to make whatever happen. But I think about all of them, and then there always
all
comes
the time,
the point,
man,
that it's like, yo, I've been thinking about you for 2 weeks now. And they're like, oh, wait, I've been thinking about you for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Let's get together.
It's like this thing that kind of aligns in the stars. Dude, I would love to Joe Rogan this and talk for like 5 hours
I have to
cut it because my kids
baby,
are so younger
time
than your kids.
Man, can we do this again?
I was going to say, I'd love to make this maybe like a part one of two.
I think we should. I think we should because this part one was very, heady.
Well, we had a lot of breaks, so we didn't get to jump in as much as we
right,
wanted to, but I feel like you got super warmed up and it was easy to dive into things that I really, really want to expand and have a very relaxed time
right
with. So I'd say we make this at least part one of two, maybe not more. We used to have the idea for a podcast together.
I know.
And I think about that a lot, actually, like, why don't we just do that?
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I would say we can stop recording here and then I'll just talk to you a bit after. But
yeah, for sure,
man, guys, I hope you enjoyed the show. And Matt, I'm really happy to have finally got you on and thank
know
you for sharing and being so open. And
I
if
it
you, whatever, if Matt sends me any links, they will be in the description below. And make sure to check out his Instagram at Matthew Paul Martinez. All right, brother, let's stop recording in. All right, you can say bye if you want also.
What's the button? R?
The R, yeah.
Yeah, bye.
Make sure
see you in part two, part three, part four.
Let's count down together. You ready? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.